News read by Jane Royce.
8 people have died as they tried to cross the channel from France to England. They were in a boat which was torn apart on rocks off the coast of Boulogne-sur-Mer in the early hours of this morning. More than 50 people were on board. Less than a fortnight ago, 12 people, including 6 children, were killed in a similar incident on the channel. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has said the UK is still discussing with allies whether to give permission to Ukraine to fire long-range missiles into Russia. Ukraine already has supplies of missiles from the West, but is currently allowed to fire them only at targets within its own borders. Mr. Lammy said the UK will be meeting President Zelensky at the UN General Assembly in 12 days' time. Mr. Lammy's defended Keir Starmer after the Prime Minister accepted donations from the Labour peer, Lord Alley, to pay for clothes for his wife. The Conservatives are calling for an investigation because Keir failed to register the gifts on time, though he has now done so. Mr. Lammy said that successive Prime Ministers had relied on donations so they can look their best. Torrential rains continuing to wreak havoc across central and eastern Europe. 7 people are known to have died in the flooding so far in Poland, Austria and Romania. Tens of thousands of people have been left without power. The Austrian province surrounding Vienna has been declared a disaster area, and more torrential rains forecast over the next 2 days. The Liberal Democrat leader Sir Ed Davey has called for the NHS to receive billions of pounds more in funding, warning that otherwise it will face inevitable decline. Health policy is the main focus at the party's annual conference in Brighton today. The government has said that extra funding for the NHS must be tied to reforms. A capsule carrying a crew who performed the first commercially funded spacewalk has returned to Earth. The spacecraft splashed down off the coast of Florida this morning. The 4 people on board travelled further into space than anyone for more than 50 years. And the weather. A cloudy afternoon with patchy rain across England and Wales. Northern Ireland and Scotland will see sunny spells and showers. And temperatures will reach 21 degrees Celsius in London, 18 in Cardiff and Belfast, and 16 in Edinburgh. BBC News at 12:02. And now on Radio 3, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Anne Cleves is an award-winning British crime writer. 3 of her crime series have been adapted for television: Shetland, Vera, and The Long Call. But it took a while for Anne to gain success. She was 32 years old when she wrote her first book, and despite publishing every year since, it wasn't until Raven Black, the first of the Shetland series, won the Duncan Laurie Dagger Prize in 2006, that she became an international bestseller. And we brought an absolutely wonderful selection of music today, including Elgar, Beethoven, but rather unusually, we're starting with the Welsh National Anthem. Why this?
That's for my father. He grew up in the Welsh Valleys. Dad was a miner and then a baker. And he went off to war, came back, did one of the post-war short teacher training courses and ended up as a primary school teacher, but was still Welsh at heart, I think, and loved rugby. So when rugby was on the television, we stood up for the Welsh National Anthem and listened to it. I just loved those male voices singing with such passion.
There's nothing quite like being in the Millennium Stadium or Cardiff Arms Park, as it used to be, and hearing those Welsh crowds really rising to this music.
Yeah, one of those communities where music isn't snobby. It's a part of the community because every village had a male voice choir. I suppose like the bands in West Yorkshire, but there's something grassroots and wonderful about that sound, I think.
Oh,
I'm in my little front room listening to that and just wishing that I could sing. I would love to be in the middle of a choir hearing those voices reverberate around me. I think it's wonderful. What a joy to be a part of that.
The Welsh National Anthem. Did you have music in your early years of any sort?
Very little, I think. My mum could sing. She was in the WI choir where we lived, and I think could read music. And she arranged for me to have piano lessons. But I think that was more a thing that you did. There was a piano in the house and learnt it and did all right, because with piano you can learn where your fingers go. But I don't have any sort of ear. So doing the exams, it was very hit and miss. You know, when they play a note and you have to sing it and tell them what the rhythm is, I was flummoxed with that.
And if you don't play by ear, then, of course, you're rather rooted to the notes on the page, aren't
you? That's right, very much. And so your focus is that rather than the flow of the music. So, no, I think I stopped when I was about 12.
And, of course, your family moved to Devon when you were still quite young.
Yes, the family moved to Devon when I was 11, 12. And that was joyous. It was as if the sun had just come out. Because before that, my father taught in a very small village primary school. It was a hamlet, really, Adverton in Herefordshire on the Welsh border. And there were 30 kids in the class, 15 infants and 15 juniors, one room with a curtain down the middle. And it's no fun being taught by your father in a school like that. I don't think I was ever invited out for tea. I had my sister, but I just remember it as being quite grey and quite cold. And the schoolhouse was freezing because we lived in the attached schoolhouse. Then when we moved to North Devon, I moved on to secondary school, so I was anonymous suddenly and made friends of my own, and life was very, very different. And I think my mother had had enough of living in tiny villages, so we lived in Barnstaple, the town.
Did you enjoy reading stories as a child?
Oh, words hit me in a way that music perhaps didn't. And I loved reading and escaped into reading and still escape into reading. Yeah, passionate about stories and making up stories in my head. I can remember before I could even read and write, a running narrative in my head in the third person describing what I was doing. And that stopped once I could read and write. But until
and presumably these weren't detective stories yet, or were they?
Not at that point. I think I was an Enid Blyton child, but soon realised that actually she wasn't that good a writer and moved on to, again, this is somebody that you may have read, Malcolm Savile, who sets his books on the Welsh marches. And he was very much a preferred writer. I can remember when we lived in Adverton sending him a fan letter.
I have to defend Adverton a little bit because I live 4 miles away. And I don't think there's even a school there now.
That's why we moved, because the school closed. It was so basic.
But isn't it funny how one's memory of somewhere is coloured by experience? Because, of course, my memories of that area are really rather wonderful. Yours are very much coloured by a certain darkness.
Yeah, I think so. And by a loneliness, I think, because I did find it very hard to make friends. There were only, I don't know, 3 or 4 other kids of my own age anyway. And they'd grown up in the village and knew people and had relatives, and I was very much an outsider. And that joy of getting a handwritten note back from Malcolm Savile saying that, yes, he did write the book set in that area.
I think you do feel that music is a great connector to memory, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah, that I've chosen these pieces because they take me immediately to the places.
So how come we have Benjamin Britten next, or is this the sea in Devon?
No, this is, again, this is my dad, and this is joyful memories of North Devon, because I think my father was a great primary school teacher, and he loved music, and he loved drama, and he loved story. And I think in a way that maybe teachers aren't allowed to now, he was allowed to express those interests with the kids. And when I was in the sixth form at Barnstable Grammar School, on Wednesday afternoons, we had time off to do other stuff. So some people learnt to drive, or some people did voluntary service. And I thought I was going to be a teacher like my dad. So I was allowed to go off to catch the train to Umberley, which is the school up the Tor Valley where he taught, and spend the afternoon helping him in school and doing mostly actually drama and theatre with the kids. And this was a piece that he would play as a sort of warm-up exercise, and they would move around this little classroom to it. But he loved the piece and I came to love it too.
Well, it has a sort of almost lonely strings at the beginning, but then the water begins to sparkle.
You're right, of course, aren't you? That is the sea.
He does manage marvellously to marry both the sort of lonely cruelty of the sea and the joyous beauty of it.
Yes, I was picturing the sea when it hits a shingle bank and then just draws back, and you can hear that flow in it too.
Dawn from Benjamin Britten's Four Sea Interludes from Peter Grimes, performed by the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Richard Hickox. So, you did sometimes conjure up stories in your mind, as you were saying, in the third person. When did you actually start to write things down?
Age 7 or 8, but dreadful stuff, you know, like awful verse and essays at school, but was always interested in what ifs. You're looking at people and character and what are they going to do next? And the people that I came across in the village, and I can remember one woman who played the church organ. I was convinced at one point that she was a witch. She looked like a witch, and I thought that she would cast spells on fellow pupils. She was very scary. And I suppose, yeah, just wanting to explore my life through fiction is what I guess I've always been doing.
After school, you had a gap year.
Yeah.
And I think you spent a lot of time volunteering at that point.
Yeah, I worked as a community service volunteer based in Camden. So that was a shock to the system, coming straight from North Devon to inner city Camden near King's Cross. And I was helping to look after a family. The mother had left. There were four kids. The dad worked on the railway. He'd been brought up in care and didn't want his kids to go into care. So Camden Social Services had a couple of volunteers in to help look after the children. They had a system called peripatetic childcare officers, which meant that people went into troubled homes for short times to look after the children. But this was for a longer period. So they had a series of volunteers for a few years, I think, until the children grew up and I was there for that short time. It was an eye-opener.
Well, interestingly, I think it pervaded that experience, a lot of your writing, even the latest novel, which will come on to, The Dark Wives, that feeling for disadvantaged people, particularly children.
I think so. I think it just seemed unfair because I'd come from this really idyllic time in North Devon. It was the best time to be young. You know, it was the late 60s, early 70s. It was beach parties, and the music that I was listening to then was Dylan. And
the music of revolt.
Yes, but also of self-indulgence, really. Sitting around campfires and meditating about our lives and loves, and with no thought really for anybody outside that circle. And then I was in Camden working for social services, looking after these kids who had very little. And we were so naive, we thought we would bring culture into their lives. And so we did have some money and we took them to ballet, I think. We dragged them off to the theatre and read loads of books to them and made them put on plays. But they had fun doing
it. Yeah,
no,
I think opportunity is everything, isn't it?
I think so. And maybe a bit of that stuck with a couple of them.
Then you went on to study English at Sussex University. How did you find that after Devon and Camden?
That was tricky. I didn't really settle very well. I loved the reading and I loved the work, but I didn't like Sussex. Didn't have a real beach, Brighton. I couldn't see the point of it.
A pathetic beach.
No headlands, no cliffs, no, none of that. And I think I was just restless after having done that work. Sitting around talking about Keats didn't really float my boat in the same way. And so, yeah, I did drop out. But the next piece of music, I think that is thanks to Brighton, to student days. I remember walking along Kemp Town where we were living in this dreadful bed and breakfast place. I think we were going to visit a friend of a friend and just heard this music coming out of an upstairs window from their flat and went in and said, "What's that?" It just bowled over by the sound of it. And he looked just as if I was the most ignorant person in the world because I didn't recognise
And it
Beethoven.
Was, of course, part of the Pastoral Symphony.
Yeah, but I did go out and buy the LP because I did want to hear the rest of it. But it made me feel so stupid and that maybe that sort of music wasn't for me, or I couldn't access it in the same way as they could.
But I don't think it matters how you come across it. It's having the opportunity to hear it and then allowing it to transport you.
I think so.
So, this is the fifth movement of Beethoven's Sixth Symphony in F major, Shepherd's Song.
Thank you. Thank you.
The fifth movement of Beethoven's Sixth Symphony in F Major, The Shepherd's Song, performed by the Malmö Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Trevino. In a way, don't you think, Anne Cleves, that what he's doing there is the equivalent on land to what Britain was doing on the water?
Absolutely, yeah. It's pastoral, of course, but in a way that makes you feel that you're there in the countryside with, well, I see, a lot of green lanes, flowers, the countryside that I grew up in, I suppose.
So, Anne, you headed back to London to work in Camden when you heard about a rather interesting job down the pub.
Yes. I had a bed sit in Putney that cost, I think, £4 a week and worked for Camden Social Services. So it was a bit of a trek to get to work every day. But there was somebody else who had a bed sit in the same house. So we were all of a similar age. And he was going off to be assistant warden in the Bird Observatory in Fair Isle. So we went to the pub to say goodbye to him. And he was moaning. He did a lot of moaning that he wasn't sure it was the right thing to do. Fair Isle was cold and windy. Maybe he should stay in London. And I said something like, well, I wouldn't mind spending a summer in Fair Isle. But I didn't know where Fair Isle was. Of course, it's part of the Shetland group. And he said, well, if you're serious, they're desperate for an assistant cook. So I went. And I think they had me because I couldn't cook and I didn't know anything about birds, because the warden's wife was pregnant and she knew she'd have to go to Aberdeen to have the baby. And they had a three-year-old child. So it was my childcare experience that they were after rather than my ability to be a cook.
Did your culinary expertise improve?
Definitely improved, because they had me back as chief cook the next year. But it's a long way. So it's 14 hours by boat from Aberdeen to Shetland mainland. And then another 3 hours in the most horrible boat in the universe to get into Fair Isle. It's the mail boat. It's called the Good Shepherd, with some irony. Admirals of the British Navy have been sick on that boat. And I was so ill when I got there.
Did you find it very beautiful, though?
I loved it, yeah. I arrived into spring and there was wildflowers on the cliff, sea pink and thrift. There were seabirds all over the cliffs, so puffins and auks and stories, just masses of stories. Mm. Only 50 people on the island, but full of tales of former years and shipwrecks and storms. And I'd go down the island and there was one particular elderly guy that I used to visit because he was on his own. He'd knock on the door. And come in. And then he knew he had to offer you something, because that's what you do. And usually it's tea and home bakes, but he didn't really do tea and home bakes. So 9 in the morning. And come in. You'll take a dram. And it wasn't because he was a boozer, but it was just that he had to give you something. So he'd sit with these thimblefuls of whiskey and he'd tell the most amazing stories. And he appears as Magnus in the first of the Shetland books, Raven Black.
In March 2019, there was a devastating fire, wasn't there, that destroyed the Fair Isle Bird Observatory.
Yes.
But before that happened, were you spending time in the observatory? Did you go and watch birds?
Yes, so I lived in the observatory when I was cooking there for 2 years. I met my husband there, I met my husband, Tim. He came into Fair Isle as a visiting bird watcher, visiting ornithologist, and Fair Isle was a relatively dry island, and I saw that he had a very good bottle of malt whiskey tucked in the top of his rucksack.
You were getting the habit.
I was getting the habit. Well, I showed him into the dormitory where he was sleeping, yes, and so we got on very well. And he came back my second year, and he worked on one of the crofts and proposed to me after a day haymaking on the top of a hay cart going back into...
Nothing could be more appropriate. And apart from the whiskey, what kind of dishes were you cooking?
Mostly at that time what we could get off the island, so lots of lamb, lots of vegetables. We had milk from the island, but we did lots of baking. If you'd lived there full time, you'd get very, very fat. Lots of sweet things, scones every day, bannocks.
You need the energy, of course.
Yes, the bird watchers certainly did, because they did a lot of walking. And yes, we went back and stayed a few times, but then the observatory burnt down and it's being rebuilt beautifully. It's coming back to life. And I can't wait to go back to the opening party there. That'll be some event.
a fiddle piece next.
Yes. This is played by Chris Stout, who's a friend, and his parents, Andrew and Kathleen, I went to their wedding party on Fair Isle. He's a Fair Islander. And it's astounding that those people who were there then, who were children then, three amazing musicians came out of that very small island. There was Chris, who still plays beautifully, Ewan Thompson, who makes astounding violins now, and a wonderful singer-songwriter called Lisa Sinclair, who died far too soon, but she was another great musician. And all those people coming out of that island, because there was, I think, when people got together, they played music. And when there was a party, there was music and everybody danced. And even people like me who came in from the outside and had no sense of rhythm, we learnt some of the Shetland dances. And so this is a bit that Chris is playing. And when Raven Black, the first of my Shetland books, was published, we did some events together where I would do some readings and he would play tunes to go with them. And this is a winter song for Raven Black. Thank you.
That has some of the lonely quality we were talking about in the Briton, doesn't it?
It really does, yes. It's very interesting hearing these pieces one after another, because I can definitely feel that. That, I think, is a New Year's Day song, but it's beautifully played there, I think, Chris.
Yes, it's called Dark Day Dawn, or The Greenland Man's Tune, and it was performed by Chris Stout, playing the fiddle, and Catriona Mackay, the harp. Interesting that music has this effect that we've been talking about, because gradually, as one goes through the programme, part of your character seems to come out. Is that rather worrying?
I think I need to be alone more than I need to be with other people. And I think there are some people who need company, and I really don't. I've got a cottage up in the Northumberland Hills that I bought after Tim died, because I was just couldn't go home after he died, because before that, whenever I'd been away on a long trip or a tour, book tour, and come in, he'd be there, and don't come into the kitchen yet. Why don't you go and sit in the living room and I'll bring you a glass of wine? And I knew that the kitchen would be full of takeaway wrappers and beer cans, and he wanted half an hour to tidy it up before I went to have a look at it. And I missed that fun of having somebody to come back to. And so the memories were too much for a bit, so I went and bought this cottage in the hills, which I absolutely love, up in Northumberland, and it's not very far from the coast where I live, but it's completely different. It's not a tourist place, it's a former housekeeper's cottage on a big estate, and I can leave the house and walk all day on a public holiday on public footpaths and not see a soul.
Wonderful.
And I love it.
Yeah. Was it a shared interest in birds that brought you and Tim together, or did he develop that?
No, he was always a birder, passionate from the age of 6 or 7, and it took me to lovely places. I travelled the world with him while he was looking for birds or looking at birds, but I never caught the obsession, which is just as well, I think. One of us was enough.
He worked for the RSPB, didn't he?
He did.
And he got a job as a warden off the Wirral.
That was when we were first married, yes, an island called Hilbury, which is between the Wirral and North Wales. And that was our first life together, just the two of us on this island. No running water, or no mains water, no electricity.
But happiness.
Yeah, we were happy there. And that's where I started writing. That's where the first trigger for the first book came. And in it, I do kill off a birdwatcher by hitting him over the head with a very heavy brass telescope. I think that might have saved our marriage. But, yeah.
We were Tim had a late diagnosis, didn't he, of a bipolar disorder. Did that come as a surprise to you, or did you realise?
No, he had bouts of depression. I don't think I knew that it was bipolar disorder, but partly that was what made him such fun, I think, because he could be very high and very jolly. But he was treated and it worked well, and the last 20-odd years of our marriage were great and stable and settled.
So, you had two daughters. Eventually moved to Northumberland, which I think takes us quite nicely to our next piece of music, does it not?
Yes, The Lark Ascending, because that's home really now. I wouldn't move south again. I love North Devon, but there are so many people there. And I love those empty hillsides. And so, yeah, The Lark Ascending is for marching over the hills with Tim and that place.
We associate The Lark Ascending with this music and forget sometimes, I think, just how beautiful the sound of a lark actually ascending in the fields is if you're just on a walk.
It sums up the uplands, doesn't it? That lark, you disturb the nest and suddenly they're up making this amazing sound.
Thank you.
that's lonely as well, isn't it? It's beautiful, and yeah, I'm there walking the hills.
The Lark Ascending by Ralph Vaughan Williams, performed by Sarah Chang and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Anne Cleves, sadly, Tim, your husband, passed away in December 2017, so that certainly brought tragedy close to you. It must have been devastating.
Yeah, it was very sudden, and we weren't expecting it. He had a minor heart attack, went into hospital, and we thought that they'd put in a stent or something. But it turned out that the heart attack had been caused by something more than that. And again, we thought he was getting better, but he died very suddenly just before Christmas. And the girls and I couldn't get there in time to see him, but he'd planned his own funeral. He spent a lot of time with his friend, his best friend, Morris, sitting in the sea-watching hide on the Northumberland coast, just waiting for seabirds to come past. Very zen, I think. Mm. And they would talk about everything. While he was sitting there, he planned his own funeral. So we knew he wanted to be cremated to the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour. He would go into that. That made life a bit easier, I think. And so many people came. He had the greatest ability to make friends. And that's probably his greatest legacy to me, that he's bequeathed me a lot of his friends who still look out for me and look after me.
What did he make of your success as a writer?
I think he was a bit bemused by it, really, because for a long time I wasn't successful. And then when it happened, it was all a bit much. I think we got on so well because we led quite separate lives. So he would go off to Uzbekistan to look for Slenderbill Curlew, and I would go to the States to do a book festival. And then we had something to talk about when we came back.
There'll be lots of people listening to this who've been through this sort of tragedy. And I wonder whether you have any feelings about how to get through the grieving process.
My eldest daughter trained as a midwife, and she reckons that grief is like labour pains. It comes in waves. And you have to know that it's going to come, but then it'll, a bit like the Peter Grimes, it fades, so it comes and then it fades.
Surges, like the sea.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that the depths of the waves get less as time moves on, but they never quite become calm.
At the time, you described wanting to escape the pity of other people.
Yes. And I suppose a sort of selfishness that he had so many friends where we lived, and they all wanted to share what they were feeling. And I wasn't interested in what they were feeling. Yeah. I had enough to do on my own. Mm. And yeah, I was very lucky that my daughters live locally to me and got great support.
And you visited Devon, didn't you, to think about a new
I did.
Idea.
I went down and stayed with my best school friend who's still living there, and we walked and we talked, and she'd grown up within a very enclosed evangelical community. And it seemed to me then that if somebody had grown up within that community and lost their faith very suddenly, they would be unfellowshipped. They would be almost cast out from friends and family. And that would leave you very unanchored. And you might turn to the police service to find that sense of honour and duty that you were missing. And also that sense of being a bit special too. And so that's how Matthew Venn, my detective, was born. And two of the people who looked after me most after Tim died were a gay couple, Martin and Paul, and who still look after me now and, you know, still get a text, you fancy a pint tonight, or we're going for a bite to eat, you want to come. So because they were rattling around in my head, Matthew became gay, which I think he always was meant to, really. But that explained the problems he had reconciling with his family, because that would have been seen as a sin.
Mm-hmm. Anne Cleves, when you started writing, I don't suppose you thought it could be a career, did you? Or?
No, for 20 years I had a book published every year, but I still had a day job or a variety of day jobs.
And was it always crime fiction?
Yeah. When I started off, I thought I was going to write a great novel about social justice or about the state of the world, but I'm quite good at creating character, I think. I can do character all right, but I couldn't think of a plot, and something had to happen. I couldn't just have a lot of interesting people sitting round in a room talking. And I killed one of them off and I was away. That was it. That was fine.
Do you have a story mapped out going from A to B, or do you just gradually pick it up as you go along?
Yeah, no, it grows. I don't plot at all in advance. I think partly because for all those years I wasn't really earning a living at it. So it had to be fun, you know. It wasn't work, it wasn't a chore, and it's still not. I still love it. And it wouldn't have been fun if I knew how it was going to end. So I just start writing and tell the story as it comes.
You love to explore the psychological reasons behind why people commit crimes in your novels and the sort of grey area of conscience.
I think so. I'm not interested in writing monsters, mad serial killers who go out and kill for the fun of it. I want to write about ordinary people who are pushed to extremes, or people who've, for some reason, have become so distressed or disturbed that they commit terrible crimes. And really, the crime isn't at the heart of the book. I think what I'm really writing about is families and what holds them together and what makes them fall apart. Yes, and communities and what brings them together and what makes them fall apart.
Music from the film Henry V that starred Kenneth Branagh next, as opposed to the very early one.
Yeah, I'd never seen this film, but I had heard the music. And again, it's voices, and it's such a memorable tune. It's a real earworm for me, and I just love it. And again, because I didn't see the film, for me there is a story in the music, because it starts off Non Nobis Domine. So the singer is really thanking God for the success. But then as it swells and all the other singers come in, I have this feeling that they become almost triumphal, and they're forgetting actually that it's not them. They're actually believing that they did it, and they're celebrating a victory that was theirs rather than not deserved.
Non nobis Domine, Domine. Non nobis Domine. Sed nomine, sed nomine, tuo da gloriam.
Non nobis Domine, Domine, non nobis Domine, sed nomine, sed nomine.
Rousing stuff.
Yes, rousing. But I think they got caught up in the moment and they forgot what they started singing about.
Non Nobis Domine by Patrick Doyle. We heard the Stephen Hill Singers and the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. Anne Cleves, your first Shetland novel, Raven Black, became a huge success. And I wonder what it was like to suddenly find that you were the talk of the town.
Oh, I'm so glad that it happened that way. I think it must be dreadful to get a huge success with the first book, because after that, the pressure to do it again and again and again must be so great. And so to spend 20 years trying to get it right, or to get it better at least, and then to get some success was wonderful. But you knew that it not necessarily going to last forever. And so you enjoy the moment. And I love the writing. I think there are some people who love to write and there are other people who love to be writers. And I love to write.
Raven Black introduced the world to Inspector Jimmy Perez. How did his character emerge for you?
Well, I thought the first book was going to be a standalone. My editor at the time said it would stretch credibility to have more than one book set in a place like Shetland. You know, how many murders could you have? But then it went on to do well, and
well,
so they changed their mind.
Midsummer Murders, yeah.
That's right. And it's about, I suppose, what it is to be an outsider. And so I wanted a detective who belonged but also didn't quite belong. And so there was a Spanish Armada ship wrecked off Fair Isle called El Gran Grifon. And so not outside the bounds of possibility that one of the sailors married a local woman and that the name carried on. I love to think of those Spanish sailors missing the sunshine and the olives and the oranges, ending up on Fair Isle with tatties, neeps and sheep.
Elgar next.
Yeah, Elgar. I'm not sure there's any reason for this except that I love it. And it's another piece of music that I feel in my gut as well as hear with my ears, I think, especially the low, growly bits.
You've chosen Jacqueline Dupré with the John Barbirolli conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. So this is a kind of historic recording, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Because she got stricken by MS. And gradually, and this is the thing which I think is so hard to understand, her ability to feel the string on the bow, her ability to feel when she was stopping the string, would gradually diminish with that disease.
Yes,
I mean, it's the worst thing.
Heartbreaking for a musician. It's just dreadful. Yeah. But I love this bit of music too.
talk about a lonely voice.
I know. What does it say about me?
That's what you're here to discover. My assistant will show you out of the consulting room shortly, so you're a wiser lady. We heard the first movement of Elgar's Cello Concerto in E minor, performed by Jacqueline Dupré with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by John Barbirolli. I mean, even if one didn't know the awful story of what happened to Jackie Dupré, the music still moves one, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely, yes.
Now, Vera is set not far, presumably, from where you live in Northumberland. You're in Whitley Bay.
Yeah, that's North Tyneside, and I have the cottage in the hills as well, so I straddle both the coast and the hills. I'm very lucky, and yet filmed a lot around there.
How did the character of Vera come to you?
I think I was very lucky. As I said, I don't plot in advance. And I was very stuck with a plot. And this story wasn't going to have a detective in it. It was about three women who were doing an environmental survey in the hills. But I was writing a funeral scene and I knew that something had to change, that I had to bring something new in. And it was the American thriller writer Raymond Chandler who said, if you're stuck with a book, have a guy burst through a door with a gun. I don't do guns, but I thought, I'm writing this funeral, I'll just see who comes in, I'll have the door burst open. And in came Vera Stanner, just looking more like a bag lady than a detective and carrying all her notes in a supermarket carrier bag. And there she was. But I think where she did come from was those early days in Herefordshire, in Kington. There were a number of formidable spinsters who ran that town, who had either lost sweethearts during the war or who had been allowed roles and responsibilities during the war that made them decide that they would rather be single than 1950s housewives. Because, of course, if you're a woman teacher and you married, you had to give up work because there were men coming back who needed the job. So I can remember my infant school headmistress was quite Vera-like.
So even this character is slightly coloured by social conscience.
Maybe. Or I'm just curious about people. I'm not sure I've got any more social conscience than the other person, but I am very curious about why people do what they do and how they are and about their lives. I'm just nosy. You know, I love that time of year when people switch on the lights and forget to draw their curtains. You walk down the street and you get these glimpses into other people's domestic lives.
Brenda Blethyn, of course, has been wonderful as Vera, hasn't she? She seems to suit the character so impeccably.
Well, I think she's just a great actor because she's a double Oscar nominee. She was great in Secrets and Lies and Little Voice as well. And I think because she reads the books and because she creates a character that's very different from herself, she says that it's complete opposite of method acting because you're not digging into your own experience, you're creating a character that's separate from you. And she does it beautifully.
She's played Vera since 2011, but recently she said that she's retiring. How do you feel about that?
I think it's sad, but it had to be Brenda's decision. And I think better to go out when people are wanting more. She had to go when she was ready. And she is, so.
I won't ask you what happens to her at the end.
No.
That might be asking for a trade secret.
And I haven't seen the script, so I don't know.
Because this is her last 14th series due out in 2025 next year. But you're still writing books starring Vera, aren't you?
Yes. The book that's just come out, The Dark Wives, is a Vera book. And, yeah, she's still in my head.
I've been enjoying it very much, and it contains so much of what we've been talking about.
I think it does. It was triggered by a Radio 4 programme, Phylon 4, looking at private care homes. I just felt really queasy that there were these companies making a profit out of troubled teenagers. So that triggered the story, I suppose. And it starts off with a very caring assistant working in a residential home for teenagers who's murdered, and a 14-year-old lass goes missing. And Vera really doesn't want to believe that she's a murderer because she's quirky, this girl. And a bit aggressive and a bit challenging, her behaviour at school, and she doesn't fit in, so quite like Vera herself. But this girl has disappeared, so did she kill the boy or was she taken? So it's a search throughout the book for this young woman. And we get bits of writing because she keeps a diary and she sends letters. I had when I was writing it, a 14-year-old granddaughter who's now 16. And I, can you read this? Is this, oh, Gran, nobody our age uses WhatsApp or Facebook. It's all Insta. So I had to change it. And the very last bit at the end is completely her writing.
A Vivaldi aria next.
Yeah. My eldest granddaughter, who's now 20, struggled when she was at school. She has ASD, autistic disorder, and didn't settle. And we thought that it was just the autism that was causing her problems, but I think she had real mental health problems at the same time that maybe we're too quick to dismiss in people who are neurodivergent. And so she really struggled to make friends. She's great now. She's at Bangor University and doing very, very well. But at school, she really struggled. And I can remember going along and they had this sort of musical evening. And she stood up and she sang this aria so beautifully. I just couldn't believe that it was her, that she'd achieved singing this and making me cry.
Beautiful melody.
Yeah, and that's an older woman's voice and obviously very mature. But if you imagine with a very light 16-year-old, I think she was maybe even younger than that, very light, girlish voice. Mm. And it was just so sweet, so beautiful.
Vieni, vieni, o mio diletto by Vivaldi, performed by Montserrat Caballé with Miguel Zanetti playing the piano. You are a really passionate advocate, as you suggested earlier, Anne, of libraries. You're awarded an OBE in 2022 for services to reading and libraries, and recently won a Public Library Champion Award.
Yeah, I think that stories have meant so much to me and have helped me through my life. And there was a time when I couldn't afford to buy books, and I did use public libraries. And I think still that those stories, that literature, that information, actually, in a world of fake news, should be available to everybody. And in the Northeast, we've set up a brilliant project called the Reading for Wellbeing Project. And we now have workers in most of the Northeast authorities setting up reading groups, working with lonely people, especially after COVID, mental health charities, and now with school kids who are struggling as well. And it is making a difference.
Your latest detective series featured a sort of community art centre called The Woodyard. Is that something you want to set up in the real world?
Well, it wasn't me that wanted to set it up, but in the book there is an old disintegrating factory on the banks of the River Tor that made window frames and doors, this huge building. And in fiction, I called it The Woodyard and made it a community arts centre where there was music, where you could have a community choir and music lessons, but there was a space for people with learning disabilities. It was like my dream. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do this? And I got contacted by some amazing women in Barnstaple saying, we run this charity for kids who've been bereaved. Where's The Woodyard? Because we want to be a part of it. Well, no, it's fiction. There isn't one. Would you mind if we set one up? So they are setting up a woodyard. They found premises. They've got money. They've got donations. They've got amazing volunteers. And the school friend Sue, who I went to stay with to trigger the Matthew Venn books, worked for the whole of her career with adults with a learning disability, and she's on the steering group too.
Well, on a very positive note, we've sadly come to our final piece. What is it, Anne Cleves?
Yes, it's Farewell to Stromness by Peter Maxwell Davis, and this is another Northern Isle. It's an Orkney composer and an Orkney tune. And for some reason, I love it. It's calming. And again, maybe it is that repetition of the sea that I hear in it. But my daughters know that when it's time for my funeral, I want this played.
Farewell to Stromness. Anne Cleves, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a joy talking to you and learning a bit more about the music and myself, I think.
Farewell to Stromness, composed and performed by Peter Maxwell Davis, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the crime writer Anne Cleves. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael Barclay's guest will be the restaurant critic Jay Rayner, whose choices reflect his own career as a jazz pianist. That's next Sunday on Radio 3 at just after midday.
BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms.
And you can enjoy them for even longer with BBC Sounds. You've got until the 14th of October to listen to any of this year's Proms. Immerse yourself in outstanding concerts from the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and hear world-class soloists including Anne-Sophie Mutter and Yo-Yo Ma. To listen, just search Proms on BBC Sounds.
It's 1:30 and time to join Sarah Moore Peach now on Radio 3 for her Sunday afternoon musical journey.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the programme where we paint a picture in music with a single piece in the foreground and a host of connected sounds from across history as its backdrop, framing it, colouring it, giving it perspective. Today our subject is a mythical bird floating on the waters that surround the island of the dead. The Swan of Tuonela, a standalone tone poem by the Finnish composer Jean Sibelius that forms part of a suite telling the story of the hero Lemminkainen from the Finnish epic The Kalevala. This ethereal music, both beautiful and ominous, is our destination in this music map, and we'll be hearing the full tone poem at the end of our listening journey. Let's begin that journey now with an encounter with another mythical swan gliding on a lake.